Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, with all of the market volatility and macro headwinds facing investors, we have the perfect guest. Back with us is Alan Patricoff, you know, an early venture capitalist in companies like America Online, Office Depot, Apple, Audible, chairman emeritus and co-founder of Graycroft. He is also chairman and co-founder of Primetime Partners. He also has a new book out called No Red Lights, Reflections on Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital and Never Driving Alone. He is here in our studio. So nice to have you here. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about that, especially since you've seen so many different market cycles. What do you make of this market cycle and the volatility we're seeing and what feels like extreme selling?
Well, you know, everybody I meet has lived for such a short time relatively in this market that they only see everything going up. And I've lived through so many cycles that to me, this was inevitable. It's going to come. Everybody was living in a euphoric state that things were only going to go up. And I think I said it on this program, I've said it every place, I think that you better be prepared for some kind of hiccup. And I don't know why it's going to happen, but that's just the way the markets work.
How big of a hiccup and how long of a hiccup?
Well, I think it depends on what the afterfall is after this initial setback. You know, will the market stabilize or is it going to, you know, after a certain period of time, go down again? I mean, the levels that the market's at has just been increasing steadily until the beginning of this year. I mean, last year was dramatic. The whole Trump era was dramatic. I always follow the theory that markets don't like surprises. And all we had was surprises for 4 years, and the market kept going up. So I think we've got an after effect of that. I just say one thing, this is not the time to sell. I think you got to ride the rocky periods and watch how and see how it stabilizes.
Even a name like, you know, you've got Meta, Meta platforms, right? You know, Facebook down about 38% this year. We were talking about Netflix before we got going. It's down almost 46% since April 19th when it just freaked out the markets, right? When it came down with a lack of subscriber growth. So I don't know, how do we make sense of some of that? Is that opportunity to you, or is it like there's something wrong?
Well, if I were following public markets, I'd be looking very carefully for where the opportunities are in terms of companies that have relatively good values in relation to their revenues and their profits, and which ones have the balance sheets that are going to sustain themselves no matter what happens to interest rates. But in terms of Meta and Google and Apple and Facebook, I think we're going through a period where, for finally, the Congress and the Senate are now focused on the monopoly positions that these companies have, and there's legislation pending, and I think that it's long been long in company. You really in coming. You realize that the internet has not had any regulation. There's been no regulation in 25 years. We're living with outdated monopoly laws, and I think that Europe has just passed some very significant laws, and the U.S. is going to follow, I think, very shortly, and that is an overhang.
Very curious about your thoughts on this, because you invest in early-stage tech companies, and you've invested in absolutely society-changing companies like America Online. Does the monopoly power that you argue that some of these big tech companies have, to what extent does that stifle innovation when it comes to startups?
Of course it does. I mean, you know, I can't tell you the number of companies I've been on the board of where I'm going to a board meeting and they'd say traffic was down 50% or 20, whatever the percentage is. Why Google changed their algorithms?
Yeah.
I mean, that's monopoly if I've ever heard it. I mean, our original monopoly laws were related to control of the railroads, the control of oil. Now we're seeing a different kind of monopoly control, and that is, you know, when you have 90% of your search going through one vehicle, and when people are putting their own internal products and offerings ahead of other products that are available, that's monopoly.
Consumers get hurt.
Yeah. Ultimately, of course they are. Well, let's put it this way. The advertisers are getting hurt. The competitive businesses are getting hurt. And I think everybody is mesmerized by, you know, one-day delivery and getting low prices. But at the same time, it's hurting a lot of small businesses.
Elon Musk and Twitter. What do you think about that? I think that Twitter, we all use it. We are enamored by it, a lot of us.
We're addicted to it.
It worries me. One person, this is the major social media communication platform. All of us, maybe not all of us, but a lot of us certainly use it. And to have one person, and this will be a private company also,
right.
I think it's, again, another element that I would be concerned about. And I think it's also going to be subject to whatever potential government regulation. I mean, he hasn't gone through this process yet. I think that we still may see some headwinds that may slow this down or prevent it. I don't think it's good for society.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because we also do wonder, you know, what it means in terms of how we think about media. Like, you know, you've been involved in these tech companies, and that really changed the way we think about media. And I mean, do you see Twitter as a kind of a traditional media company? I mean, so many people get their news from these social media companies. We see the influence, but how do we need to think about them? Are they entertainment? Are they media? Are they what?
Media. I mean, I mean. Twitter has a major influence on what happens. Someone can tweet something and it can influence the market. And, you know, if Elon Musk prevails, it could very well become the Wild West. And therefore, I think the government is going to, and, you know, Section 232 is something that's very actively being discussed. And I think at some point that will come in and under some kind of regulation. It's been pending for so long.
The Wild West in what sense, very briefly?
That Elon Musk can do anything he wants with it. A private company, he could,
right.
You know, who knows what he could, you know, I can just conjure up all the things that he might use this for as a personal toy. He's got a lot of money, and I don't know how much he's going to be controlled by these investors that he's getting. It just worries me. I don't think it's good for society that one person controls major media. Just like I think there's a concern about Facebook having the strength it has, and Google and Apple having running a toll booth, all these things are gotten to a point where I think we got to deal with it.
We're going to continue with Alan Patchikoff, and when we come back, we're going to talk about his new book. We do want to get into it, because he has seen, as he mentioned, so many different market cycles and understanding the creation of some incredible companies. So we're going to continue with Alan Patchikoff. His new book is No Red Lights, Reflections on Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital and Never Driving Alone.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Alan Patchikoff is our guest. You know him well, of course. Chairman Emeritus, co-founder of Greycroft, co-founder of Primetime Partners. He's got a book out, No Red Lights, Reflections of Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital and Never Driving Alone, here in studio. Do you want to tell the story?
Well, you were I was asking,
I saw that you went to Ohio State. Yeah. It's where my wife went. And I asked, if you're not from Ohio, how you ended up there.
I was going to tell this story because I've told this story many times. If you're at a dinner party and you go around the table and someone says, I went to Colby. Someone said, I went to the University of Wisconsin. Someone, I went to Harvard. Someone said, I went to Dartmouth. And they come to me, they said, and I say, Ohio State. It's always the same thing. Just what you said. How come you went to Ohio State?
Ouch.
You could go any place. But Ohio State gets that reaction.
The Ohio State University.
The Ohio State University.
So why did you go?
I'm going to get busted when I get home.
Yeah, you are.
No, I went there. Frankly, it wasn't my first choice. I had intended to go to Brandeis, and it was very early on in the history of Brandeis, and it was much more religious orientation when I was going. It was like the second or third class. And I went to a preliminary get-together, and I got scared. I was there all by myself, so there was no one to give me guidance. And so I went home and pasted the label over Brandeis and put down Ohio State.
My father, exactly.
In spite of that, you know, at least I get a visit from the president the college every once in a while.
So talk to us about this book. We were reminding you, we talked about this, that when you were on last with us, which was a few months ago, you actually leaked that you were coming out with a new book. So why did you write this? Why did you want to finally sit down and do it?
Yeah, I mean, I've been asked for a long time to write a book because I've been in the business. You know, by being in a business 50 years, you become first you're the father of venture capital, then you're the grandfather of venture capital, then it's the legendary Alan Patchikoff. So, being a legend, and by the way, this past year, I was awarded the Legion d'honneur by the French government because I started the first venture firm in France. So I'm now a legend in this country, and I'm a Legion d'honneur in Paris. But I wrote it because, for two reasons. One was, I thought it might be valuable. And why I gave the title of No Red Lights, I've lived a multidimensional life, and I feel that that's a valuable idea to convey to younger people about don't get lost in your own, you know, small world. Be open to opportunities and get involved in politics, get involved in charities, get involved in art. And I've done all of these things, and there's not much that I haven't been involved in or that I'm not open to. Mm-hmm. And I live a very active, multidimensional life and always have. And I thought that spirit would be valuable to convey. Plus, I saw what was happening to older people who are, you know, kind of checking out because of retirement ages being forced on them at 60, or they've sold their company, and they go to Florida, and they start playing golf. And I was saying is I started my first company at 36, my second company at 72, and 2 years ago I decided to start Primetime Partners at 85. Mm-hmm. And I thought that I wanted to be a poster child. You know, I'm now 87. I thought it would be kind of inspirational. I don't want to, you know, overdo it, but that people who might read it say, listen, if this guy can do it, you know, why can't I do it? Why can't I? Maybe if I only inspire one person to say, you know, I'm going to follow that lead and mm-hmm. take on some new challenge, go back in the same business I've been in, only do it all over again.
The subheadline of the book is Reflections on Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital, and Never Driving Alone. What do you mean by never driving alone?
Is that everything in life is cumulative. We don't get where we are by doing things by ourselves. I find it's very valuable to always be in partnership with people in whatever you do, and I follow a very collegial approach to everything I've done. And I find it it's a very good practice to be open to meeting new people at all stages. And as I say, life is cumulative, and the people you meet early on in your career, they come back at you again and again. And I can tell you that, which I say in this book, many of the people I met when I was very young in this business are all running some of the major companies in this country, or certainly in this city, but in the country. And I say to everybody, you know, turn to your left and turn to your right. You just don't know where someone's going to end up. And you develop those associations and relationships. And I find that's been very helpful in my life.
You know, Alan, I think many would argue, you know, certainly coming out of the pandemic, and we just saw the speed of change and innovation pick up so much momentum because companies had to for survival, whether it's digitization or, you know, we talk about digital medicine, like just so many different things in how we shop, just so many things kind of just picked up so much momentum. But there was, many would argue, a lot of innovation during what was a very, very difficult time. And I just wonder, when you have looked at innovation over 50 years, like, what is it that stands out from somebody, whether it was an Apple or another company, that you just knew that this was somebody or an institution that was on the cusp of doing something very differently?
Well, you know, no one has that much foresight that they can pick winners all the time, because as part of the business, there are a lot of losers in the process. But, you know, what you'd like to find is someone who's got a vision and who's passionate about what they do. And I think that is fundamental to being really successful. I mean, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was a perfect example, who was a passionate person. Sergey and Larry were passionate. Steve Jobs was passionate. I think that if you're driven, that has a lot to do with not just knowing the technology, but have a vision of what you want to do. And one of the things that concerns me is I give a lot of lectures or courses and colleges every now and then, and when you ask people in these business schools, you know, how many of you are going to start a business, you know, three quarters of the class raise their hand, and they have no passion really about what they want to do. They're doing it because someone in the previous class started and made $5 million and sold their company, and they figured, if they did it, why can't I do it? So as a result, they start a new dog watching company or a new delivery company. And so we have a lot of a lot of repetition, not as much originality in the startup and innovation as we'd like to, frankly, as I'd like to see. You know, most things today are applications of existing technologies. You know, there aren't that many breakthrough technologies that are happening. They're happening, but I mean, not...
Metaverse?
Yeah. Why is that, though? Why are we not seeing the
breakthrough
technologies?
Now, you mentioned Metaverse. Yeah. I found Jaron Lanier, who discovered...
Microsoft guy years ago. Yeah.
No, Microsoft. Before that, Jaron Lanier was the guy who founded artificial...
AI?
AI. No. Virtual reality.
Oh, VR.
I got
okay.
myself. Yeah, VR. And I found him at the bottom of the electronic show out in Las Vegas, and sitting at a fold-up desk. That was in 1984, you know, and the metaverse is now here in 2022. So it takes a long time sometimes for these great technologies to evolve. That's a perfect example.
And he's now skeptical of a lot of types of technology.
He's written a book, and actually our meeting is in that book. And I don't know if it's one line or two lines, but, you know, a lot of things people, you know, take time to evolve, and they don't just automatically happen. And if you don't stick with it and have that, you know, vision, it's not going to get fulfilled.
You know, when we were at Milken this week, and we were talking about Milken, you know, because you certainly are familiar, and you would talk about Milken in the early days, but so much the growth of private markets versus public markets. And I do wonder, you know, what you think is the future for public markets. I mean, is there enough private capital to keep startup companies? We see them staying private much longer, giving them a longer runway. You know, does that continue, and do public markets continue to kind of diminish?
I don't think so. Okay. I think you've got to find a way for exit for employees. I mean, I'm involved with one company I can think of in particular that's a private company, and they're running into the problem that, you know, people have options, and they have, it's great to have these options, but, you know, they're sitting there, and how do you realize on the option they want to buy a house? And you've got to find a way. At some point, you've got to be able, people find they have to monetize it in some way. And I think that's always going to create a demand for companies going public. I don't think we're going to go through a period where people are all going to stay private.
Just got about 30 seconds, 40 seconds left here. So I think we started out just crazy market environment. I'm thinking about your book and just life lessons. So in an environment like this, what, everybody take a breath and pause? Like,
I think you don't get scared in times like this and sell and, you know, run for the, this is the time when, you know, the drums are playing, you look around carefully to find out where the values may be. And we are going into a more value-oriented era. I've, you know, been saying this for a long time. When I started out, it used to be PE ratios. Now it's price times revenue or price times EBITDA.
We might be going back to PE ratios.
Exactly. That's my point.
Alan Patchkoff, thank you so much. The new book, No Red Lights, Reflections on Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital, and Never Driving Alone. Perfect voice to have on a day where we did see so much selling and a lot of volatility.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we caught up with our next guest last time on Valentine's Day, one of the big days for anyone in the flower industry. Another big day is Mother's Day, which is this weekend. And I got to say, when we are in a volatile market environment, lots of questions about the economic outlook and what happens next, I really think it's crucial that we reach out to small businesses and business owners. And so this is a perfect guest for us to be talking about right now.
We're talking about the founder and CEO of Farm Girl Flowers, Christina Stemble. She joins us on the phone from Seattle. Christina, great to have you back with us. Just give us an idea of what you're seeing. You have such an interesting read on the American consumer because you're seeing what they're ordering, how they're browsing, what they're buying when it comes to farm girl flowers. How is the state of the American consumer right now, or your customer?
Yeah, it's definitely. Yeah, I think, you know, our customers are really, you know, it's female, 25 to 44. It's a very common consumer for e-commerce sales, and so I think we have a good read on what's going on. It's definitely, you know, we've seen softening sales for months now. You know, we're in the midst of Mother's Day and are having actually a much better Mother's Day than I anticipated, to be quite honest. But, you know, I'm very worried like everybody else and you know, very interested to see what's going to, you know, come with the interest hikes and things like that, as we're already experiencing really, really intense supply chain issues and things like that.
Well, that's it. Like, you know, that's interesting, too. So I want to get into that. You talk about, though, you've been seeing a softening of sales. So does that mean less people are ordering, or is it a case of people ordering, but they're going for smaller, you know, less expensive options? Give us a little idea, some color on that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great differential. Like, you know, kind of there's two different things going on. And, you know, so far we've seen just fewer sales, which, you know, a lot of it's attributed to the, you know, new privacy settings and you know, marketing in general has been much more difficult, challenging since it gone into effect last year.
Wow.
Which we're all, you know, now learning about with Facebook's, you know, mm-hmm. reported revenues and things like that. And, you know, so we're seeing a lot less traffic even just coming to our site, and it costs a lot more to acquire customers. Much, much more than it used to. And so we've already had to take a, you know, really good look at things and see if, you know, is it a smarter, is it wiser decision to just cut off marketing or really limit our marketing, which is what we've done, and consciously become a smaller company because it's not worth anymore. You know, if it's going to cost $60 to acquire a customer to spend $90, it's just not worth it. And so,
wow.
You know, there, we've already had, you know, been looking at that. And then now, you know, I've done a lot of research, as I'm sure every company is doing right now, at what happened in the last recession. It was before we started in 08. You know, we started in 2010. So, you know, looking at public companies in our space, in our industry, it looks like just what you said. You know, they still had the same amount of sales, but their average order value went down considerably. So now we're looking, you know, what I'm looking to do for Farm Girl is to make sure that we're kind of recession-proofing our business as much as possible. And, you know, what does that mean as far as, like, you know, people are spending $20 less per order and going to smaller sizes? Going into 2023, can we absorb that with such small margins as a company in general?
How do you recession proof your company?
Yeah, it's a good question. come back, maybe next year we can talk and see if it works. But, you know, some of the things that I'm looking to do is, you know, creating products that use less labor. You know, we've already kind of, you know, been easing into that with, you know, American consumers. You know, it's been hard to find labor at affordable prices, especially, you know, we're not a software company. We build products every day, and you know, we rely on wage level and, you know, team members, and wages have gone up considerably. And so, you know, with having tiny margins with perishability, you know, we've had to already kind of start doing this, but continue to kind of lean into that even more, and, you know, doing lower labor options that are still, you know, high. We can't do high designs for low prices. And so, you know, with higher inbound and outbound transportation costs already going into effect, you know, that we've been experiencing since COVID, we've had to figure out where can we cut some of our costs. And that's not in transportation. It's not in flour costs with supply chain prices going up so much. And so labor is the only thing that we've really had to work with. And so we're going to continue trying to you know, tweak that as we go into what could be a recession in 2023.
You know, the last time around, I think we talked about a recent story that had mentioned you about how you were foregoing growth opportunities in an effort to take on less risk. And I feel like it's a theme, and it may be a theme applicable to you and a lot of others in this environment. Is that still the case, though?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're fortunate, and I never say this, we're fortunate being a bootstrap company. You know, I tried to raise capital and couldn't, and got a 104 no's. And now I'm actually really grateful for that because, mm-hmm. you know, I've been able to make the decision for our company to really focus on profit and not on growth at all costs, which was kind of the, you know, e-commerce, you know, tech company motto for so long. But you can't do that if we go into a recession, right? Cash is going to be king. And so, you know, we've this year especially really, you know, we became a smaller company last year in 2021, and we continued that into 2022 intentionally because we need to make sure that there's a margin. We can't just go into the red like a lot of companies do to show really great numbers to their investors and boards. You know, we need to have a bottom line, which is going to be really important for companies, I think, going into this next phase.
And at the end of the day, Christina, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, that could be better in the long run.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we forget that most companies in our country are bootstrapped mom and pop, you know, type mm-hmm. companies, private companies. And those companies have always had to like kick it old school. Like I call it, like, where you have to spend less than, you know, than you make. And so that's yeah. definitely where we're at. And I think companies are going to have to go to that model if they aren't already there.
Well, we wish you well and really good to check in with you. Like we said, it's talking to small businesses that really give you an idea of what's going on in this economy. Christina Stemble, she's founder and CEO of Farm Girl Flowers, joining us on the phone from Seattle. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Alan Armstrong is in our studio as president and CEO at the Williams Company, as we mentioned here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much.
But you're glad to be not a big tech company or something like that. Talk to us about the outline. You are a pipeline operator. That provides you, what, some insulation in terms of some of the volatility?
Sure. You know, we're really in the business of transporting. We actually connect the very largest basins here in the U.S., natural gas basins. We connect about 15 different supply basins into the very best markets here in the U.S. And so with our Transco system, we serve all up and down the eastern seaboard, really coming out all the way starting in Corpus Christi, Texas, all the way through Atlanta, Charlotte, D.C., Philadelphia, all along the eastern seaboard. And then in the northwest, we serve all the major metropolitan areas in the northwest, including Seattle and Oregon as well. And then we serve the Florida markets with our Gulfstream pipeline. So we really are in the very best spots for growth and demand here in the U.S. and serve most of the LNG export facilities here in the U.S. as well.
All right, we'll have a lot of export questions too. I want to start though with prices and just your outlook for prices this year. Where do you see them going, given that natural gas prices have more than doubled so far this year?
Yeah, you know, really the challenge for price, it's really interesting. You see the price of gas in Europe, and of course has, you know, gotten extraordinary and could go even higher depending on where things go on that front. But here in the U.S., you're seeing, you know, prices in the $8 range versus the $30 range and plus that you're seeing in Europe. And the reason for that is lack of infrastructure. It's not any more complicated than that. We have plenty of low-cost supplies here in the U.S., and we have the ability to grow our supplies here in the U.S., but the U.S. producer is not going to continue to produce gas when there's not incremental takeaway capacity. So, for instance, take a Marcellus and Utica producer, and they were counting on the Mountain Valley Pipeline being completed, which would have been a nice, mm-hmm. attractive market outlet for their gas. Once that project got stopped, they had to slow their drilling down. Otherwise, all they were going to do is just compete against each other for the same market outlets, and the price would drop dramatically in that inter-region basin. And so they are very, very dependent on infrastructure. It is not as complicated as people want to make it. It truly is just about us having enough export capacity and having in the way of LNG facilities and having enough pipeline infrastructure to get it to those incremental markets.
What is the outlook for exports, considering what's going on with the war in Ukraine and really Europe rethinking, you know, who is going to be its energy partners going forward?
Yeah, well, a lot of great progress has been made here in the last 3 or 4 months on contracting for export facilities. And Venture Global's new facility came up in at the Calcasieu terminal earlier this year. That's the latest of new capacity to come on. And there is a lot of new contracting that's being done right now.
Contracting mean being talked about?
No, contracting in terms of people actually signing contracts
okay. For
the capacity. That's the good news. The bad news is that simply starts the process for permitting and constructing the facilities. Now, the good news is there's a lot of facilities here in the U.S. that are already permitted. But even with that, you're talking about a 2.5 to 3 year, even on a fast cycle, to get that LNG export facility built. And so that is that the export facilities are one of our big challenges.
Is that, though, the long-term play? No doubt about it, because of that war in Ukraine?
Well, I would say actually that kind of supercharged the issue. But if you think about it, before Ukraine came along, Europe already had its energy crisis. Recall that Germany had shut down a lot of their nuclear facilities and their coal facilities, relying on wind. They had a low wind resource year, and as a result of that, they were running very short on natural gas. That was all before Ukraine came along. Ukraine has added, so the first part of that was...
So this was already happening in
this
terms
was
of
absolutely already,
partnering the or prices contracting
had already,
with the
US. Prices had already gone there.
Okay.
But then the turn to the U.S., was then very much focused around Ukraine, because remember you had Nord Stream 2 that was going to come on to provide incremental supply. Mm-hmm. That was a Russian supply, obviously. And so once that project got stopped, there needed to be incremental supply coming out of the U.S. And so, as I say, it kind of supercharged the issue, but the issue of being short natural gas in Europe had already presented itself ahead of the Ukrainian crisis.
So what's a realistic timeline about when we can see meaningful production increases of natural gas here in the United States, given the infrastructure challenges you highlighted?
Well, the three primary areas for supply are going to be, the Haynesville, the Texas and New Mexico Permian supplies, and then the Marcellus and the Utica. The Marcellus and Utica are by far the largest and the highest potential for long-term resources that we have. But the reason the Haynesville is first is that it's in Louisiana, and it is where a lot of this incremental demand for LNG is building up. And so you can build pipelines in Louisiana without having to have a federal permit. And it is the federal process that has really stymied the ability to get the infrastructure built. And so that is why you're seeing the Haynesville be the place that you're seeing a lot of rigs attracted to in the gas supply industry and the pipeline infrastructure, just because of the differential in permitting process.
Alan, we'd be remiss to not address the volatility that we're seeing in the market environment today. And we are seeing a lot of selling, certainly on the equity side, lots of talk about stagflation, concerns about the Fed, missing it when it comes to a softish landing, which we heard from Jay Powell. How do you see it? What are you seeing from your customers that tell you what about the economy for the next 6 to 12 months? I'm not quite sure what visibility you might have.
Yeah, well, sure. If you think about who our primary...
I mean, you did raise your CapEx. I mean, you guys are optimistic.
Yeah, well, so if you think about who our customers are, on the one hand, it's natural gas producing customers, and on the other hand, it's the demand side, mostly utilities and LNG customers. So those are kind of our primary sets of customers. And
Chesapeake, Lockheed Martin, these are all customers.
Chesapeake is a big customer of ours. The Southern companies, Duke, Dominion, all of the big utilities, Con Ed here in New York City. So those are our big customers. And I would say on the utility side, they are absolutely stuck on and moving ahead with natural gas and converting a lot of the coal as they look to a very complementary source of fuel with renewables. So lots of investment on renewables,
right. But
knowing that they've got to have strong backup capacity for those facilities. If you think about it from a Williams perspective, we sell capacity. We don't sell the actual molecule, we sell the capacity. And so if somebody is putting in a power generation facility, they can't just buy for the utilization rate times the capacity, they have to buy for the full capacity. So we have a tremendous amount of demand for incremental projects. We have 6 projects under execution right now.
Is that a lot from what you've done historically?
So that's 1.9 BCF a day. Yeah. That's about 2% of the U.S. Demand today. And that's just what we have in execution. We have 25 other projects that are in the development stage right now.
Well, such a delight to have you here in studio. Thank you so much. I know you're going to join some of our TV colleagues to continue the conversation. But, Alan, thank you. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Alan Armstrong, he's president and CEO at the Williams Companies here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. And as we talk about, you know, if you look at the major industry groups in the S&P 500, it really is those energy names that have been the outperformers certainly this year and last year.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
The question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody. As you know, we are seeing selling on the equity side of things. Stocks plunging as traders really fret about the Fed's quagmire. I mean, how do they slow down inflation without slowing down the economy too much? And there's lots of concerns about stagflation, meaning that the Fed doesn't get it right when it comes to inflation. But we do see slowing growth. And so the trade, although I will point out, we're starting to see a little bit of buying. So we're just bouncing off our lows of this session. Still down 5% on the NASDAQ, down 3% on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and Tim, the S&P 500 is still down about 3.5%.
Really curious to hear what our next guest, Jimmy Lee, has to think about a day like today and all the volatility that we have been seeing of late. He's the founder and CEO at the Wealth Consulting Group. They've got $2.7 billion in assets under management. Jimmy joins us on the phone from Las Vegas. Jimmy, I'm not even going to ask you how you're doing, but I do care. But I'm wondering—
You could be shorting the market and doing really well.
Are you?
Unfortunately, I'm not.
Okay. All right. So I do want to know, what are the calls, what are the emails that you're getting from clients today?
I actually did get one email this morning. I'm actually in Washington, D.C. at an investment conference, talking to a lot of money managers today, actually. A lot of interesting views. But I did get an email that my assistant forwarded to me from one of my newer clients as of the last few years, father of a very big client of mine and a friend, but a little nervous. Told me that if his portfolio hits a certain dollar amount, he wants out. So certainly, retail investors are starting to get nervous. And of course, these last 2 days of volatility, I think, reminding some people of what it was like March of 2020. And maybe those have been around a little longer, maybe the financial crisis. A lot of volatility the last 2 days, especially when we haven't had a whole lot in the entire year of 2021.
Well, March of 2009, I remember when we bottomed out, and that turned out to be an incredible buying opportunity. And even if you go to March 2020, yep, looked pretty dismal. But ultimately, we saw, you know, incredible gains, you know, once we saw all of the assistance, government assistance kick in, and really assistance for different industries to prop up the markets, basically, to be quite honest. All right, you said you're at this investment conference in Washington, D.C. What's the tone and sentiment? We just came from the Milken Institute Global Conference out on the West Coast. A lot of private sector individuals and private market individuals who, yes, were concerned, but certainly not as concerned as those that are in the public market. So what are you hearing, if there's a consensus?
I think the probability of a recession in a lot of money managers' eyes has gone up. And so I think, you know, talk to a couple of fixed income managers that control hundreds of billions of dollars, and a little different take maybe on which parts of the bond market and the yield curve they want to be invested in today. But I think overall, if you're thinking that we're going to avoid a recession, you're probably a contrarian. I still actually think that we could. I know it's probably not going to be very easy. I don't think inflation is going to go away very quickly. But I will say this about volatility. You know, in midterm election years, and we're smack in the middle of one right now, the average decline in the S&P 500, according to FactSet, is a negative 17%. That's the average in a typical midterm election year. Now, I know that this year's a very special. Another fact from FactSet is that after we hit low, which is typically in the end of summer, August, early fall, September.
Ooh, buckle up.
The one-year return is a positive 32%. So for those of you that are thinking that this could be a buying opportunity, history would support that.
Now, what's most important in terms of market direction, though? Is it being a midterm year? Is it a Fed rate tightening cycle? Is what is the metric that might determine where we go from here? It's a tricky one.
Well, in my opinion, it's inflation and the Fed. Of course, the war in Ukraine is furthering the issue that we have with supply and inflation, especially with oil and gas, but and some food areas, grains and things like that. But it's certainly, for me, inflation and the Fed, and that's not positive currently. But, you know, this year is tricky for investors because bonds are supposed to give you diversification against equities, and they haven't worked this year, right? So I think this year has shown for us in our portfolios that active investing is extremely important in times like this in both the equity and fixed income markets. And so is the use of alternative investments, having assets that are non-correlated to both bonds and stocks possibly. And so I think asset allocation is more important today than it ever was, even though many people have been poo-pooing it for years now. And so I think we're still up against this backdrop of a tightening Fed and, late to the game in terms of increasing interest rates and fighting inflation and not really, being certain and telling investors what's going to happen once they start selling bonds and reducing their balance sheet. And so there's a little uncertainty there. And it was incredible, that we saw the rally that we did yesterday once Chairman Powell started talking and then today the sell-off. So obviously, there was a little bit of buying on the dips. But, selling on the upside is probably more of a trend that we may continue to see. So I view that we're going to continue to see a lot of volatility. And as some of the issues get resolved, such as maybe the war in Ukraine, who knows when that's going to happen.
Right.
But if we get some resolution there, that's going to take some pressure off of maybe oil. You might see commodity prices come back down.
Huh.
If you start to see some, negative news.
There's a lot of ifs in there.
Well, yeah, but I actually do see it in some areas, right?
Okay.
So, yes, consumers are very strong, a lot of money in the banks. I think people are going to spend like crazy. I've been traveling a lot myself, and the prices for airline tickets,
yeah,
for hotels are very high. I don't think that's going to stop. I think
it's going
to continue to go.
Right.
And the trend to going to spending on services versus durables, certainly that's there, but
yep.
I think that if we get some better inflation data, that could look good.
Well, that's what everybody seems to be saying, that if somehow the inflationary numbers start to come down, that certainly would alleviate a lot of concerns by investors as well as the Federal Reserve. All right, Jimmy Lee, thank you so much. Founder and Chief Executive Officer of the Wealth Consulting Group, joining us on the phone from a conference, an investment conference in Washington, D.C.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.